Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. This afternoon, the Secretary of State in Alabama will certify Democrat Doug Jones as the winner of this month's special Senate election. But Jones's challenger, Roy Moore, filed a lawsuit last night alleging voter fraud. Moore lost by about 20,000 votes. Earlier today, I spoke with Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill, and I asked him if there was anything that would stop him from certifying the vote today.
Not that I'm aware of, unless there's some kind of court injunction that's issued between now and the time that certification will occur, which is 1 p.m. Central Time this afternoon.
What do you say to Roy Moore's charges that there was voter fraud in this election?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to note that we take voter fraud and voter integrity very, very seriously. And one of the things that we've done is we've provided the citizens of Alabama with a mechanism to report any kind of voter fraud that they believe needs to be investigated through our website at stopvoterfraudnow.com. And we have received more than 101 complaints as of yesterday at 5 p.m. where people have alleged that fraudulent activity had occurred. We have investigated as many of those as possible from the time that they began to come in, and more than 60 of them have already been adjudicated, so 40 plus remain active. But it's important to note that the four most serious charges that we've received have all been vetted and all been cleared.
Well, when you say that the charges have been adjudicated, did you find that there was fraud or wasn't fraud?
No. There was no fraud in those particular instances. One of those, which was very concerning to a lot of people, had to do with a town that was approximately 20 miles south of Birmingham that had about 2,200 residents and more than 5,000 people actually voted in the election. This town is called Bordalama, and that is very, very frightening to think that that occurred, except when you realize that there is no town or community in the state of Alabama called Bordalama. So that was all fictitious. It was made up. It was just a lie that started on the internet. The second thing had to do with a series of reports that we received with five busloads of African Americans that were allegedly brought in here from Mississippi and allowed to vote in the Mobile area. And there was no truth to that. That was completely fictitious. It was made up. It was a lie. Third, there were allegedly three van loads of people from Mexico that had come to Alabama that had been allowed to vote. After they voted, they were arrested and incarcerated. That, too, was a lie. There was no truth to it. It did not happen. And last but not least was the one that was most concerning to a lot of people. It had a young man who was featured on a news broadcast from Fox 10 in Mobile. The reporter was live from the Doug Jones headquarters in Birmingham, who said, and he was unidentified. It said, we all came here from all different parts of the nation. We all voted. We all canvassed. We got our boy elected, Doug Jones. Doug Jones, he starts shouting and screaming Doug Jones' name as he bounces away. And I was able to identify him. We were able to investigate the situation. We discovered that he indeed is now a resident of Alabama. He's not from Alabama, but he's been living here for more than a year. He has a job. He works here. He's registered to vote. He did campaign for Doug Jones. He exercised his right to vote on December 12th, and his vote counted just like mine did.
Now, you voted, as you told us, for Roy Moore. You're a Republican. You've been around the state politics for a long time. Are you surprised that you're seeing one of the candidates contest the results of this election?
Let me tell you something, my friend. Nothing surprises me anymore. Nothing. This is unbelievable. This entire process has been unbelievable. I do think it's important for your listeners to know that we take each and every claim that's presented to us very seriously. We have to investigate each and every one of them with the full enthusiasm, energy, and vigor that we possess to make sure that people know that it's important for them to share their information with us. And yet we have not had a single incident that's been introduced to us that has had any validity to it to date.
That's John Merrill, the Secretary of State of Alabama. Secretary, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you for having me as your guest.
Well, let's go to Utah, where the influential Salt Lake Tribune newspaper has made a declaration. Senator Orrin Hatch, they've decided, he's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, they've decided he's the Utahn of the year. Well, George Pyle is editor of the editorial page at the Salt Lake Tribune, and he joins us. And George, normally when a paper names someone as person of the year, it's an accolade, but that's not exactly what happened here.
I mean, there's two things going on here, which the senator himself and other people seem to have gotten a little mixed up. There's the front page article that we do every Christmas where we name a Utahn of the year. And one of the criteria is who was the biggest newsmaker. On the editorial page, we went to some lengths to make it clear that the person who did the most is not necessarily the person who did the most good. And there were three specific things that we highlighted. One was the senator's role in convincing the president to roll back these two national monuments in Utah. We have favored those national monuments. We favored the creation of Bear's Ears. The Navajo and four affiliated tribes of the Southwest had worked on this for generations, weren't able to get Congress to act, and so President Obama, as he was on his way out, proclaimed this monument. The Grand Staircase Escalante was proclaimed during the Clinton administration in a process that was not nearly so transparent, but it's been there for 20 years. People have adapted to it. Businesses have grown up in anticipation that it will be there forever.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Pyle, the second point that you make about why Senator Hatch made the most news of any Utahn has to do with the tax code. I just want to jump to the third bullet point here, because you say his utter lack of integrity that rises from his unquenchable thirst for power. That's the part I didn't expect.
Well, I guess they didn't expect it either. But 6 years ago, Senator Hatch ran for re-election in what is now his seventh term. We endorsed him for the same reasons that Orrin Hatch would tell you he should be endorsed: his experience, his influence, but also the things that he said he was going to get done, and his pledge that it would be his last term. More recently, he's been making noises about how he might run again after all. He hasn't officially declared, but he has been raising money. And again, he's frozen the field.
Well, one of the reasons why your selection of Senator Hatch for Utahn of the Year caught a lot of national attention has to do with Senator Hatch's own response. He tweeted a couple of days ago, quote, "grateful for this great Christmas honor from the Salt Lake Tribune." Now, I'm going to just give him the benefit of the doubt and wonder if he was referring to the news side profile that you talked about, and perhaps he hadn't read the editorial.
Oh, I think that's probably true. Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't think, you know, the front page is a huge picture of Senator Hatch says Utahn of the Year, a relatively short text on the front page to accompany it that says he's had the most influence. And then they tweeted that out. And then people all started reading the editorial and said, well, he didn't read the story. Well, maybe he did read the story, but he didn't read the editorial. I mean, you would think United States senators and their senior staff would know the difference between a news story and an editorial. But I know a lot of intelligent people who don't know the difference between a news story and an editorial. It's a fight I've been fighting for 40 years, and I'm going to be fighting it forever.
Well, so to that point, I want to ask you, an editorial board, whatever it wants to say, it can say. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the editorial page is in line with the community of readers around it. How many Utahns feel similarly that Senator Hatch has served ample time in the Senate and should come home?
Well, there are some polls that indicate that we're not so much of an outlier, that you ask the question, should the senator run for re-election, and you have upwards of 60% saying, no, he shouldn't. You have people specifically saying that they would prefer that Republican Mitt Romney take that place on the ticket. And Jenny Wilson, who's a member of the Salt Lake County Council, is running as a Democrat for that seat. In some polls that have been put out there, especially when you just put out the name, Jenny Wilson, Orrin Hatch, and you don't attach party labels to either name, Jenny Wilson beats him.
Interesting. It does make me wonder, though. I mean, looking back at, again, from the editorial's perspective, the criticisms that you have of Senator Hatch, I mean, what difference would it make if it were him or any other Republican? Because basically, he's voting in line with the party all the time.
Yes. And if it were Mitt Romney or any other Republican, probably 95-98% of the votes that would be taken in the Senate would probably come out the same way. Personally, I think that the way Senator Hatch has just been sucking up to the White House and the president is just embarrassing. The other day he said something about, you know, he's the best president in generations. He might be the best president ever. And I was particularly struck where he said something like the best president I have served under. Now, Orrin Hatch is a senator. He's one of 100 senators. He's chairman of the Finance Committee. He is the president pro tem of the Senate. The president pro tem of the Senate does not serve under the president. He is a leading member of a co-equal branch of government. And what's really, really wrong with Washington these days, from my perspective way out here, is that the institutions are taking a back seat to the parties. I think the founders would be aghast at how the president pro tem of the Senate does not stand up for the prerogatives of the Senate. Congress in general does not stand up for the prerogatives of Congress. This is party completely overwhelming the institutions of our government.
Well, George Pyle is the editorial page editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back in June, 32-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, was appointed Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia by his father, King Salman. And he's already making his mark with bold and controversial policies, from a purge of corruption among Saudi elites to a brutal war in neighboring Yemen. Joining us from Riyadh is Bernard Haeckel. He's a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Professor, welcome. And just tell us what we should know about Mohammed bin Salman. What is the short version of who he is?
Well, he is the king's son. He's in his early 30s. He has been chosen by the king to succeed him. So he is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And he's been entrusted by the king to accomplish two broad aims. The first is to build up the country's military capabilities so that it becomes less dependent on the United States, which has historically been its protector. And the second goal that he has been entrusted with is to reform the economy, to diversify it away from its near total dependence on oil revenues, and to build up the private sector and to create employment in the private sector rather than in the public sector, which is where most Saudis work today.
What about some of the moves that he's made to liberalize the country? Women have been given the right to drive. Movie theaters are supposed to open. Is that him, or is that somebody who's telling him to do that?
No, I suspect it is very much him. He's a young person who leads a population that is extremely young. 70% of all Saudis are under the age of 30. And he feels that the policies of the past, which included promoting very conservative social mores, a form of Islam that was extremely restrictive, is bad for the country, is bad for the economy. It makes young people not like to stick around. They want to go on vacation overseas, and he wants to be able to build up as much as possible the capacity within the country to keep people happy. And so he started a ministry for entertainment. He also realizes that women are the better half of the population in terms of human capital. They are the better educated, the harder working. And so if he wants to build up the private sector and diversify the economy, he's going to have to rely more on women than on men. And he's done many other things. I mean, he has broken with a great number of traditional policies of the Saudi royal family. In effect, he's leading a revolution from above. So far, bloodless, thank God.
Well, he was in the news last month because he started a purge of Saudi elites accused of corruption, as many as 500 people arrested, many of them detained without due process in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. There's been a lot of speculation about what's behind that. Do you think it was a genuine crackdown on corruption or just a consolidation of power?
Well, he had already consolidated power by the time this purge had happened. So I think it is really about ending a culture of corruption that involved taking kickbacks on every contract that the government signed. That doesn't mean that corruption will be ended. in the country, but it will certainly be restricted very significantly, or at least so he hopes. And in so doing, that the country will be able to sustain itself economically and not incur budget deficits like it has been for the last several years.
But when it comes to elite behavior, this guy, Mohammed bin Salman, he's got $500 million yachts. And the New York Times reported recently that he may have been behind the purchase of a $300 million chateau in France in 2015. Is he really so different than the people he's cracking down on?
No, I think that, you know, as the king's son and as an extremely wealthy individual and as a future king, he feels that he is not beholden to adhere to. You know, as someone who will be the king, you know, he's not a Gandhi, he's not an ascetic, and he feels that he's entitled to spend that kind of money, and he's a rich man. He doesn't see it as corruption, and in fact, he sees his own personal behavior as a form of entitlement that comes with being crown prince and being king.
What about his foreign policy? He pushed for this war in Yemen that has become a humanitarian nightmare. What does he hope to accomplish in Yemen?
In Yemen, he sees Iran as having taken advantage of the chaos that had enveloped the country in, you know, beginning sort of in the middle 2000s, and that they had, that Iran had developed a connection to a proxy militia in Yemen, and that what the Iranians wanted to do in Yemen was to build up a force like they have built up in Lebanon with Hezbollah, with which to threaten the kingdom, especially with the use of ballistic missiles and sort of militia, paramilitary, cross-border activity. And he feels that this is a national security threat to the kingdom, and he won't permit that to happen. So he got engaged primarily as a way of stopping Iran from, as he sees it, meddling in Yemeni politics. And he sees Yemen very much as his backyard in the way that, for example, the United States would see Mexico. It has cost the Yemeni population a tremendous amount, but Yemen was already actually on the verge of implosion before the Saudis got involved. The Saudi involvement certainly has made things much worse.
What's his relationship with Israel?
Not clear. You know, there are a lot of rumors about his relationship with Israel and that there is intelligence sharing and that there is some coordination when it comes to Iran, because they both Saudi Arabia and Israel share an enemy in Iran. Officially, the Saudis, you know, have not recognized Israel. They were not for President Trump's decision to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel. He sees Israel through the United States as a potential ally in the war against Iran, but not a country that he would ever normalize relations with.
When you say the war against Iran, do you think that Mohammed bin Salman sees a day when there actually is a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Yes, I mean, possibly, because he sees that Iran, the regime in Iran, is determined to destroy the Saudi ruling dynasty, and he will not permit that. And if necessary, he will also resort to proxy actors. He will fight the Iranians in Yemen as he is doing. And he sees the relationship, or at least the conflict with Iran, as a zero-sum conflict. If a war is, you know, has to happen, he would hope that he would have the Americans on his side.
It seems from the tweets by President Trump that President Trump is certainly on the side of MBS. Is that fair to say?
When it comes to Iran, absolutely. And so is Israel. I mean, both Saudi Arabia and Israel see Iran as an existential threat.
But what's the relationship like between Mohammed bin Salman and President Trump or the Trump administration?
I think it's a fairly good relationship. As you know, President Trump's first visit overseas was to Saudi Arabia,
right,
to Riyadh, where he was feted and, you know, was given the royal treatment. And he seemed to appreciate that greatly. I think to understand the relationship with President Trump, you have to understand that the relationship with President Obama, the Saudi relationship with President Obama, was extremely bad. You know, it probably was the nadir, the very lowest point in U.S.-Saudi relations. And they were very thrilled, the Saudis, that is, to see a president, a new president in the United States, who did not want to open up to Iran as they thought President Obama wanted to do.
Now, you've met the prince yourself a couple of times. What should we know about him that we wouldn't, you know, read if we were to read a profile of him?
Well, I mean, he's extremely charismatic, and he's a natural-born politician. I mean, he makes you feel like you're the center of his universe when he's speaking to you, which is a kind of a trait that I think you're born with. And it's uncommon in the Saudi royal family. I felt the same way when I once met President Clinton. Hmm. But he's also a force of nature. I mean, he's on, he seems to be on all the time. He does a lot of his communication through WhatsApp, including with other leaders in, around the world. He's very connected to the internet. He follows Twitter intensely. But you also get a sense when you meet with him that this is a person who can be extremely tough. He has a toughness, kind of a take-no-prisoners aspect to him that is quite palpable. I mean, he's also very big. He's physically very imposing. Hmm. You kind of understand why he was chosen by his father when you meet him, because he has this intensity and this toughness, but also kind of a raw intelligence and this politician's touch that I mentioned earlier. So it's quite a compelling combination. And as a politician in Saudi Arabia, the young seem to like him greatly and identify with him. And you have to understand that that's because he comes after, you know, 30 years of sclerotic rule with kings who are in their, were in their 80s, and where nothing seemed to ever happen in the country. So he's extremely popular as I speak now. Of course, that can change if he doesn't deliver on these economic promises. And I think people do identify that he's a breath of fresh air and something hopeful for the country.
That's Bernard Haykel, who is a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, talking with us about the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
More than 12,000 high school students in the United States say they were diagnosed with a concussion last year, the majority due to participation in sports. In Wisconsin, student athletes now have access to free concussion insurance. Rachel Morello of WUWM reports.
During a meet last year, Elizabeth Sullivan was swimming in a pool measured by the meter. The one she's used to practicing in at her high school in Glendale, Wisconsin, is measured by the yard. The race was the individual medley. Sullivan hops in the pool and shows me the sequence as she switched from backstroke to breaststroke.
So I was counting my strokes, and I must have taken an extra stroke, and I collided into the wall on my turn, and I hit my head. And I came up from my pullout to do breaststroke, and I was like, I can't see. I might be just tired. And I did two more strokes, and I was like, no, I think I really just hit my head, and that really hurt, and I was just, like, kind of scared.
Does it make you nervous to do it?
Yes. Like flashbacks.
Like one out of every five student athletes across the country every year, Sullivan suffered a concussion. Luckily, she got immediate attention from trainers and doctors and recovered from the injury. Not every kid is so lucky. That's why this year, for the first time, the Wisconsin Athletic Association purchased concussion insurance to cover the 80,000 kids in grades 6 through 12 who play sports at WIAA member schools. The policy, offered by a national insurance company, costs the WIAA $1.50 per kid. It's free to all WIAA member schools. It's intended as a secondary insurance, so if a student or family already has insurance, that kicks in first. If not, the new concussion policy will cover all associated medical costs, things like prescriptions and doctor's visits.
I think perhaps the biggest impact might end up being upon what parents may do or do differently.
Dave Anderson is executive director for the WIAA. He says the growing research in the last several years about long-term impacts of concussions might have some parents worried. And he hopes this new insurance policy will give them some peace of mind if they decide to let their children play sports.
We're very excited to be able to provide this safety net and don't ever want to see concern for concussion or concern for receiving treatment to be a reason that would prevent a youngster or a family from taking part in school sports.
seems like you can't open a newspaper or turn on the TV without hearing so-and-so got a concussion, which makes people scared. You know, oh my gosh, is concussion going to turn me into these NFL players?
Dr. Kevin Walter directs pediatric and adolescent sports medicine at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. He cautions that parents don't just need to be able to cover the cost of concussion-related medical visits. He says it's also crucial for them to make sure coaches keep an eye out for their kid and that teachers provide a helping hand. Nicolet High School swimmer Elizabeth Sullivan says her injury did cause her some trouble with headaches, which in turn made concentrating in class and doing her homework tough for a while. But she says her teachers and coaches helped her through it. And after 4 weeks of recovery, she was eager to get back in the pool.
You just always have a good time. You're like, yeah, I go there every day. I know the people in there. Like, I'm totally fine. It's so much fun.
The WIAA is the fourth state sports organization to offer concussion insurance to its student athletes. In Montana, which adopted the program in 2015, close to 100% of schools take part in the program. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Morello in Milwaukee.
Let's take a closer look at America's favorite meat and the role that chicken has played when it comes to antibiotic resistance. That's the rise of strains of bacteria that cannot be treated by common antibiotics. Journalist Maren McKenna looks at this issue in her new book. It's called Big Chicken. And when I spoke with her recently, I started by asking McKenna how prevalent antibiotic use is in the poultry industry.
At the moment, we don't actually know.
Oh.
Because in the data that's tendered to the FDA every year by the makers of veterinary antibiotics, there has been no requirement to break it out by species. That will actually happen for the first time in the data that we ought to get by the end of this year. But what we do know is that chicken is the most consumed meat in the United States and growing in popularity around the world. It will be the most common meat eaten in the world soon. And since the very beginning of the antibiotic era and the beginning of the industrialization of poultry, antibiotics have played a key role in making poultry and other livestock as well, rapidly produced and cheap.
Right. I mean, in the book, you write about how antibiotics have been so difficult to root out of modern meat because, in a way, they created it. What do you mean by that?
So we use antibiotics in livestock, all kinds of meat animals, for a couple of different reasons. We use them to treat diseases, of course. No one argues with that, not even me. We use them to make animals grow faster, to put on weight faster. And we use them to protect against the diseases that they get from being crowded together in barns and feedlots. And all of those uses go back to the very beginning of the antibiotic era. They have existed for decades. Being able to grow animals more quickly caused us to sort of start thinking of them more like widgets than like animals, to turn them from chickens into the single thing of chicken. And then once we started thinking about moving them through the process more rapidly, farms started to get bigger, and antibiotics made it possible for farms to get bigger yet. So antibiotics really underpin the entire system of producing livestock.
Right. Well, I wonder if you could tell us the story of one particular antibiotic, specifically as sort of as a way to help us understand the scope here. I mean, because you write about oreomycin. Give us some background on that antibiotic.
So oreomycin, which the trade name for which is chlortetracycline, is one of the first drugs that starts the antibiotic era. Penicillin comes out in about 1943 onto the open market, and oreomycin is licensed in 1948. Oreomycin is a drug for people, as all the first antibiotics are, but one of the chemists that works at the company that makes oreomycin, a man named Thomas Jukes, has the idea to test whether tiny doses of oreomycin can be used as a feed supplement. It's the end of World War II. The food system is very fragile. They're looking to take expenses out of producing meat. And so he conducts an experiment in which he gives chickens are essential to this story, different supplements, and the ones that get oreomycin grow the fastest. So oreomycin turns out to be the drug that teaches agriculture how to misuse antibiotics, first in chicken, and then chicken really teaches the rest of agriculture how to do it too.
Wow. In the book, you write about visiting a farm with someone named Will Harris, who tells you that, in this process of industrial poultry farming, that he says they just bred all the chicken out of the chicken. What did he mean by that?
So Will Harris is a fantastic person. He is the proprietor, the fourth generation to run a multi-species pasture-based farm in South Georgia, a farm that began as a subsistence farm and then, as many, many livestock farms did in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, became a fully industrial, very sciencey, entirely relying on antibiotics and hormones cattle farm. And then he had a kind of realization that this was not the way he wanted to live the rest of his life. And he took all the hormones and antibiotics out of the system, all of the artificial feed. He turned his cattle onto grass. He brought in many other species to do a kind of rotational grazing. And chickens are a really important part of his process. Mm. And the chickens on his farm, which are like chickens in other parts of the world, as well as in other pasture-based farms in the United States, are chickens that are very different, just even physically, from the chickens that come out of very large industrial-scale farms. These chickens have colored feathers. They are more upright. They can fly. They feed themselves. They scratch around. They move around fields. And the chickens that are in the very large barns that until very recently have depended very much on antibiotics are they're white and they're docile and they tend not to fly anywhere. They mostly sit in one place and they get up and they feed themselves and they drink some water and they get back down. And they were designed that way by successive breeding by the poultry industry starting in the 1950s to be a chicken that would be more meaty, that would have the kinds of white meat that we like to eat in America, that would be docile because you need a docile animal if it's going to agree to be confined in that manner, and that would also grow very, very quickly. The average age at slaughter of an American chicken raised in that manner, a conventional chicken, is about 42 days.
Wow. Wow. How long have we known that some antibiotic resistance may be emerging from the heavy use of antibiotics in the poultry industry?
A shockingly long time. This is one of the things that was most amazing to me in excavating this history is that I think people have some sense that the discussion about antibiotic use in the production of meat is something that's been happening just in the past couple of years. And maybe people who've been in public health for a while might realize that we tried to ban this and failed in the United States in the 1970s. But in fact, the first objections to it, the first warnings that this might give rise to antibiotic-resistant bacteria moving off farms, either in meat or in manure from the animals that then washes through the environment. Those warnings go back to the very first experiments, to the late 1940s and early 1950s. And that realization prompted other governments in England, in Scandinavia, in the European Union to put curbs on farm antibiotic use from as far back as the 1960s to, in the case of the European Union, 11 years ago.
Huh. Well, so specifically regarding American poultry farming, though, a cynical take would be that the genie's out of the bottle here. Like if we were to put restrictions on antibiotic use here or ban them entirely, for example, amongst poultry, I mean, wouldn't that call for a drastic change in farming practices? And is that – how realistic is that?
So this is the argument that some people in the industry made for quite a long time, that for as good or bad as this is, we cannot now change. We can't make protein less cheap. We can't take antibiotics out of the system. Animals will get sick. It turns out that that's not true. And one of the things that was most encouraging to me in reporting this long story is that it was some poultry companies that led the way in proving that wasn't true. The company Purdue Farms, which is the fourth largest chicken company in America, in 2014 announced that they were on a journey to going antibiotic-free, and they are now effectively antibiotic-free. They use antibiotics in maybe 1% of their birds per year. They do things instead like giving them more space and allowing them to exercise and changing their diets and giving them herbal supplements. And they have managed to do that, to convert their company and not to go broke and not to lose customers. In fact, they did it because their customers were asking. So the contention that we have to use antibiotics because without them the system will collapse turns out not to be correct.
Well, in thinking about Purdue, you also write about how Chick-fil-A is moving towards breaking with the use of antibiotics. And I had forgotten about this, but McDonald's, in 2015, said it was going to go antibiotic-free for chicken in its North American restaurants. So we've just got less than a minute here. Are market forces taking care of this problem? I mean, perhaps the need for regulation isn't there.
Market forces have helped, and they helped because consumers pushed them to. But the reality is that regulations are necessary because unless you set regulations, everyone will sort of carve their own path, right? And in Europe, it was shown when they did their ban that it didn't work as well as they thought. In fact, just today, the World Health Organization urged governments all over the world to move toward very sharp cuts in antibiotic use in livestock with the recognition that as much as markets and consumer pressure move us in the right direction, we really need some degree of rulemaking as well to make sure that we stay where we're going.
Well, Maren McKenna's new book is Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. It's a tremendous book. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much.
2017 was, if nothing else, a year in which we got a lot more alerts on our mobile devices. You could call it the year of the push notification. Will Arimus is senior technology writer at Slate. He's on Skype and he joins us to talk about that. Hi, Will.
Hey, good to be here.
And do you think that push notifications reached a new level in 2017?
Oh, absolutely. In almost every way. I mean, the urgency of the stuff we were getting on our phones through push notifications seemed like it was heightened in a lot of ways due to various cultural and political forces this year, but also just the importance of push alerts to media companies has increased as time has gone by. Companies, especially like the New York Times and Washington Post, now see these alerts as one of their core ways of connecting with their readers.
Yeah, I mean, you focus on the media companies that are doing this. Of course, they're not the only ones sending out push notifications. People get them from, you know, Instagram and all the apps that they're using, even their banking apps, perhaps. But yes, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the news organizations have been sending a lot in the last year.
Yeah, and they worry about sending too much. So I for this story I wrote for Slate, I talked to the push alert teams at both the Washington Post and the New York Times. They both told me independently that they worry about something that they call alert fatigue. And that's the idea that if you send too many alerts in one day or in a short period of time, some people are going to say, you know what, stop bothering me. And they are going to either turn off their alerts for your publication, or the worst case scenario is they actually go and uninstall the New York Times or Washington Post app because it's too much for them.
What's the payoff for them of sending out these push notifications?
Well, there are at least two ways in which these push notifications have been crucial, especially for organizations that specialize in hard news, breaking news. One is that the economy of online news uses attention as a currency. So anything you can do to get people's attention and to get their eyes on your site is going to drive your business. And the second is that just getting people to click on your stories or just getting people's eyes on your site when you have a particularly sensational headline or a provocative tweet or Facebook post is not enough, because what these platforms like Facebook and Twitter have done is to untether the headlines you see from their source, right? So you see the headlines in your Facebook feed, but who they're coming from, what news organization those headlines are coming from is, that's not the first thing you see. And so you click the headline rather than selecting your source, as you used to do in the print days. You know, you would buy the Times or the Post and then read whatever headlines they had. And the issue for media companies has been that has eroded their direct connection with readers. They now are reaching readers via these intermediaries and their algorithms. Push notifications restore a little bit of that direct connection with readers, because if readers turn on push alerts from your publication on their phone, all of a sudden you have a direct line to them that skips the Facebook and Twitter algorithms. And so you can finally reach them again with stuff your editors think is important rather than just whatever headline happens to surface in their social feeds.
Now, of course, you can always say that you don't want push notifications. And actually, I think on almost every app, when they ask me, do you want push notifications, I say no. But there are some that you say yes to. Do you think that all of these push notifications are leading to an unnecessary level of stress in America?
Yeah, and I think anybody who's feeling that might want to consider doing what you do. It's the same thing I do. By default, I turn off all my push notifications, and then I can sort of opt in on a case-by-case basis. I say, you know what, I do want to get notifications from this one app because it's too much. I mean, it really has changed the way we use our phones. We used to open our phone and then sort of proactively decide what we wanted to do on it, right? We would flip through the home screen and maybe another screen full of apps, choose the app we wanted to spend some time with, and then spend that time? Well, when you give your phone over to push notifications, the phone sort of controls you, right? Like, you don't decide anymore, I'm going to open my phone, I'm going to do this on it. The phone or, you know, your apps decide, hey, I'm going to reach out and tap you on the shoulder and force you to look at me for a little bit. And that can just, I mean, it's already hard enough to control the time you spend on your device without having your device constantly nudging you and saying, hey, look at me, listen right to me, I've got something very urgent.
Well, actually, the one thing that I allow to cause a vibration on my phone is a text message. And earlier this year, I decided, you know what? I've had enough of this. I don't need to be bothered. When I look at my phone, if there's a text message, I will see it. And so I turned off the vibration for the text messages. And after about a month, it was driving me crazy that I didn't know when I got a message. And so I turned it back on again. You can't quit this stuff.
No, and in fact, I had quit the news alerts earlier this year because it was just overwhelming. And there were breaking news stories throughout the day, every day, especially early in the Trump administration, where just a lot of norms of the presidency were being questioned and broken. And so I turned them off. But I found after a while that I'll turn on one at a time. You know, I'll turn on the Times or the Post. I don't need three different organizations sending me the same story at the same time. They actually do race, by the way. They keep track of which publications have beaten them to a given push alert, and they're all racing against the clock when they compose these alerts in their newsroom.
Everything in moderation.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that especially in this time, the news is a good thing to take in moderation.
That's Will Arimus, senior technology writer at Slate. Will, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.